This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. Today we'll begin our show with an author. We've done that before. Stephen Wingate is the author of the new book just out, The Leave Takers. It's published by the University of Nebraska Press for its flyover fiction series. And Stephen is an associate professor of English at South Dakota State University. He joins us to talk about his most recent work. Stephen, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Again, the name of the book is The Leave Takers. Why did you want to tell this story?
I don't know if I wanted to so much as I had to. There's a lot of emotions wrapped up in any kind of novel that you write. If you're going to spend a long time on a book, as I do, maybe a little too long, you're going to be wrapped up in it emotionally, and it's going to resonate with you. If it doesn't resonate with you, it's not going to resonate with readers. So one of the big factors in my life is losing my dad when I was 10, and more recently lost my brother about 5 years ago. Having grief and losing the people I love, it's kind of a big thing for me. And it's also a big thing for the characters in this novel. So for me, writing The Leave Takers was really a way of dealing with grief and observing the way grief unfolds in the rest of our lives.
So this was a process where you were kind of analyzing yourself as you're writing a fiction story?
Well, a little bit. I think the process of fiction is not very straightforward. Raymond Carver had a great quote saying, you are not your characters, but your characters are you. Each character I create, whether male, female, you know, whatever age, is some part of me distilled and kind of sent off in its own direction to do its own thing. So they resemble me because they come from me. They can't come from anyone else but me because I'm the one who put the words on the page. So there's necessarily a connection between the artist and the work. And I think every work has a different level of connectedness to the autobiography of the author. There are some crucial elements of this that are autobiographical, but I'm definitely not the characters, and I have almost none of the same experiences as the characters. But that's the way fiction works. It's a very alchemical process, and one that I really love.
It's a love story, I guess, about the relationship between Jacob and Lainey. For our listeners, sketch out the story of The Leave Takers.
Lainey and Jacob, they're two artists. He is from Boston, and she is from L.A., and they had met in Los Angeles 4 years before the beginning of this novel and come pretty close to getting married before things just kind of fell apart. And here we are 4 years into the future, and they meet by chance in South Dakota, where Jacob is now living. And many things have changed in their lives, including more people dying on them. So they're kind of both sharing grief and mourning, and they also share a low-level but very, very tenacious addiction to a variety of prescription pharmaceuticals. So there they are in South Dakota, and they say, you know what? We really need to get it together, and who better to try getting it together with than this other person who really understands my problems? So they end up moving to this windswept house in north central South Dakota, right outside Clark. And they make their last stand and try to develop a real life together. So it's a love story, but it's not a romance novel. It's definitely it's a tough love story because they have to work through a lot in order to get to a point where their marriage is going to work.
Now, you mentioned that Jacob's from Boston, Lainey is from L.A. They meet in L.A., but the story really takes place mostly in South Dakota. Is this symbolic, in a sense, meeting in the middle? Or is it just because that's where you are now?
Well, a little bit of both. I think this is partially a story of migration. In the big picture right now, in our region, there are a lot of people who are coming here who are not from here. And it's kind of changing the shape of what this region is. And I wanted to reflect that because there's just a whole lot of influx from both directions. The infilling of the middle, it's a real thing. And also for me personally, yes, it's definitely about me kind of coming to terms with being in South Dakota, which is not where I was born. I'm an East Coast kid originally, but when I was 13, I moved to Colorado, so I'm kind of a Colorado guy. But I've been in South Dakota for 10 years, so I'm a little bit geographically displaced myself. And after my first flyover fiction novel came out with the University of Nebraska Press in 2019, I realized, you know, I'm going to be in South Dakota for a while. It's not a place that I'm going to leave anytime soon. You know, my kids want to be here. Their older friends are here. They want to graduate from high school here. And I needed to kind of reconcile with that because it has not been an easy transition to come in as an East Coast / Colorado guy to come into South Dakota. There's a lot of unwritten rules I don't understand. So writing this novel was my way of sinking myself into this place and coming to some kind of understanding of what it is that I'm about here, and also my own perspective on the place. I can't write about this region the way somebody like Larry Watson can, who knows the territory inside and out. My perspective is that of the outsider, and it took a while to embrace that, but I think I've done it now, and I don't want to let it go because there's a lot that can be said from the perspective of the outsider.
Well, the two principal characters in your book, the Leave Takers, Lainey and Jacob, are outsiders, and that's part of their story.
Absolutely, and they're both trying really hard to fit in and find a place for themselves in the world. They want more than anything to have a home because they've lost their family and they've kind of lost their homes. So here they are trying to just make a stand. I think it's easier for Lainey to come in from LA because she has no experience with South Dakota until she gets here. Jacob had lived here as a teenager briefly and has some resentments about the way that he was treated there. So he doesn't have the same kind of acceptance of South Dakota that Lainey has. So it's a interesting, complex dynamic and one that I really enjoyed working with. I like complex dynamics as a writer. I don't like things that are just very easily black and white. I like stuff that's shades of gray and where those shades actually change a little bit over the course of the book.
Stephen Wingate is the author of The Leave Takers. It's out from the University of Nebraska Press. Stephen, the first chapter in the book really caught my attention. I began the book, but I really read the first chapter very carefully, and it was very touching. And you mentioned the fact that you lost your dad 10 years ago, your brother 5 years ago. This chapter was published back in 2013, I'm obviously updated or rewritten for this book, but how did this chapter become the book? Because it's so important what happens in this chapter.
Well, my dad actually died when I was 10, so it was even longer ago. So I've had that kind of hole in my psyche from him for most of my life. And this was originally published by a magazine back in Boston in 2013. It's kind of the centerpiece of what makes Jacob a not fully whole person. He lost his family. His dad did murder-suicide, killed his mother and then himself. And this really scarred Jacob and his brother Daniel. And they never really quite got over it. And ultimately, years later, decades later, Daniel ended up killing himself on the same day. He just kind of gave up and said, "That's it, I'm done." And Jacob's left holding the bag. So he's got a lot of guilt. He's got that survivor guilt on two levels. Number one, could I have done anything to stop my family, my father, from losing it? And then could I have stopped my brother from killing himself? So he's got a lot of burdens there, and he's got a lot of things to fight his way through in order to find some kind of light.
Your characters, particularly Jacob, see ghosts. And I'm just wondering if Stephen does too.
No, not in that way. I don't have, a Ghostbusters type of mentality, and I'm not searching for Bigfoot. But I do think that we carry dead people with us everywhere we go.
Yes.
I mean, we carry our ancestors without even knowing who they are. We carry on conversations with the dead people in our lives. And that's something I wanted to capture with Jacob. You know, Joan Didion has a wonderful book about this called The Year of Magical Thinking, which basically covered her time after the death of her husband. And, you know, it really resonated with me. My dad's been dead for so long, I still carry on conversations with him, even though I don't know his voice anymore. He stopped talking to me in dreams and started writing down notes. It's a very weird phenomenon, but a very important one, because these people aren't, well, they're dead, but they're not really dead, because as long as we're remembering them, as long as they are part of our psyches, they still have some kind of existence. And I wanted to honor that, especially in the name of my own family dead.
How long did it take to write the book?
Oh, far too long. Doug, if there's one thing I could change about my life, it would be writing books faster. This book, originally, very first drafts go back to about 2003. And it was not continuous, not a continuous time working on this every day. I think I would have lost my mind long ago. But writing a version, putting it away, going back to it, building it, adding more layers. So I would take, you know, a year off, 2 years off, 4 years off, and then just go back to it. And that's the way I like to write, because it gives layering to the text. It captures that slow change of people's personalities. We are the result of many different layers of who we've been and who we're turning into. And slow cooking a novel like that allows me to do that in a way that I really like. But I would like to, you know, maybe take 2 years to write another novel someday. I think that would be fun.
So is your writing process that you have this idea, you write some stuff down, and then you kind of percolate about it? You're teaching at the same time, you're doing other things, and then you come back to it and maybe rewrite a bit, maybe add another chapter. Is that what we're talking about here?
Almost. What I do is I usually start with a image of a person in a place, always, actually. So for Jacob, the image that started him was, you know, those barns that are all over the West and that are just look like they're about to fall down any second. And it feels like you can just walk up to them and just push them in the right place and they would go.
Yeah.
I was driving around one day and I don't remember even what state I was in, but I saw, imagined a man just putting the lightest bit of force on one of those barns to see just how little force it would take to knock that over. And that person stuck with me. So I started asking lots of questions about him and just kind of let my imagination wind a character around that image. And that became Jacob. And ultimately, when it came time to write that novel, I just wrote it. I just didn't think much, didn't think about the plot. I just wrote what I had, and then put it away, come back, look at it again, kind of as a whole. So everyone's got their own method for writing novels. I know some people who just say they're going to do 2,000 words a day and that's it, and they just do it and it's over. Me, I'm a draft writer. I like to just go in there and go whole hog crazy, writing it as much as I possibly can until it's done, so I can capture the integrity of that feeling. And then when I go back into revision with fresh eyes, I do the same thing. I just go for it and get that moment of my interaction with the story captured, knowing that there will be other moments that I can also capture as well. And if I can really get in there and capture that moment, capture that intensity of the feeling, then I think I'm doing the right thing. And it's also very, very fun. I get charged up when I write that way. I don't know if I could handle just putting myself on a ration and doing it that way. Everyone's got their own style, and we all ultimately teach ourselves.
So are you improvising the story here? Do you know where the story is going when you start, or does it develop?
I vaguely know where I'm going, but I don't know how I'm going to get there. The general arc of beginning to end, and even the general scope of how big of a novel it's going to be, that's pretty clear to me right at the very beginning as I'm conceiving it. But how I'm going to get there, I don't know yet until I'm actually writing it. So, and I love that discovery. And I want that discovery for myself, because I want my readers to have a sense of discovery in the book as well. I don't want people to think, "Oh yeah, I know what's coming next," because that's not fun.
Stephen Wingate is the author of The Leave Takers, available from the University of Nebraska Press. How did you pitch this book to the press?
Well, they knew me already because I had my first novel of Fathers and Fire published with them in 2019. So I had a contract that said, "Hey, you need to show us your next book before you show it to anyone else." So I did, and they liked it. So it was a pretty easy pitch. The first pitch was a little harder. You know, it also took a lot of deciding. My first book came out in 2008, and it was from a New York publisher, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and it just didn't sell well enough to make the New York people happy. And I spent years just kind of beating my head against the wall, saying, "What do I do here? Why, you know, I can't seem to please these people. Where is my writing going to go?" And for a while, I even stepped away from fiction and did some interactive digital work, which was a lot of fun, although very exhausting. And finally, it was around 2016. I'd just gotten tenure at South Dakota State, and I said, "What am I going to do? What if I die tomorrow? What's the book that I want representing me? What do I really want to make sure is out there?" And it was my first novel of Fathers and Fire. And I knew about the Flyover Fiction series, which is edited by Ron Hansen, who's a Nebraska writer. And it's dedicated to the stories of the Great Plains. So it ranges all the way up into from Winnipeg all the way down to San Antonio, and from basically Denver to the Iowa Minnesota border around there. And I thought, this is where I should be. And I'm not going to please the New York people. I need to find a press that's going to match what my goals are. And I'm a Great Plains guy. You know, my territory is between Colorado, you know, the foothills, and, you know, eastern South Dakota. So it's perfectly congruent with what Flyover Fiction wants to cover. So I said, "I'll send it to them and see what they think." And they liked it. And I'm really glad, because it's very rare for a writer to have a publisher who's so matched with their agenda. It's a perfect fit.
The Flyover Fiction series by the University of Nebraska Press. Of course, flyover is where we think we are these days. We call this flyover country because people are flying from LA to New York or vice versa. I was caught by something I read on page 146 of your book, The Leave Takers, and this is something that is said by Karen. She and Doug are sort of supporting characters in the story. And she's talking about this place where they live and the people they live among. And she says, "Stephen," I'm quoting, "the ideal South Dakota woman is the farm wife, capable, physically tough, knows exactly how much of everything you need to get through the winter, wastes absolutely nothing. I don't get any respect because I'm all about book learning, which is frivolous to them. Book learning isn't necessary to get through winter."
I own up to that. I own up to that. You know, that's part of my, you know, like I said, moving to South Dakota it's not an easy thing. You know, it's a continuous self-questioning. It's a continuous questioning of my environment. I didn't grow up in this kind of environment. And, you know, when I hear people talking about life on farms, I have to stop and ask them questions. What exactly do you mean by that? And I think for people who are coming from outside, like Jacob and Lainey are, and like I am, there's a lot to learn, and there's a lot that you just can't understand unless you really dig in and try to figure out what things are. So yeah, that character, those two characters, Karen and her husband, they're from South Dakota, but they have all sorts of international interests. So they're always trying to get out. They're interesting characters. I like them.
It's also a reminder that the small towns are filled with people who know all about everybody because they're small enough to know what their neighbors are up to. Whereas in LA or in Boston, you've got that kind of, well, anonymity, if you will. But these people know who everybody else is, and sometimes they're not terribly friendly to outsiders.
And Jacob, you know, he has that problem. You know, when he came to live with his great uncle after his family blew apart, he didn't feel particularly embraced, and he resents South Dakota for that. And you know, I'm not resenting South Dakota. I think finding a way to write this novel is in some ways making sure that I don't resent South Dakota for that, because I have a different relationship to the place now that I've published a book that's set here. So it has actually really kind of helped me be part of the place and understand what my role in the ecosystem of South Dakota is, particularly the literary ecosystem. I know that I am this person who's not from here, but I'm writing about here from the perspective of other people who are not from here. So it's really kind of helped me figure out where my place is.
Why do you think you became a writer?
Oh, I remember this very well. I was 16. I got skipped ahead when I was a young kid in school. So I was very young, senior in high school. And I had forgotten to take my English classes because I was going to be a scientist. I was particularly going to be a wildlife biologist and be the next Jane Goodall and go out into the world and study apes. And they said, well, no, you actually have these graduation requirements. You can't take these science classes. You have to take these English classes. So I said, okay, I'll take the English classes. And I had a couple of great teachers who really blew my mind. And I read a bunch of fantastic books, all really close to each other. Faulkner, Conrad, Nathaniel West, Flannery O'Connor. Just all these people, they blew my mind. And I realized human beings are so much more interesting to study than monkeys and apes. Because, you know, they make a social mistake and they're ostracized or they're killed. We make social mistakes and we may go on inflicting our pain on other people for another 80 years. So we are just so much more interesting. And that was the moment when I said, you know, I think I can do this. And it took forever for me to figure out what kind of writer I was. I started poetry, I did screenwriting, I've done all this stuff. And it wasn't really until my 40s when I said, you know, I think I need to go back to fiction because fiction's what kind of pulled me into this. So I'm a late starter, but better late than never.
What are you working on now?
Right now, I'm working on a collection of short stories, and they're all in the Great Plains. They range from Colorado, you know, outside of Denver, to the Brookings area up here in South Dakota, north to Bismarck and south to Wichita. So it's my territory. And they're all a series of short stories. I wanted to kind of explore the range of the Great Plains territories that intrigue me. And if I wrote another novel, it would be likely set in one place. And I have a much more enhanced sense of myself as a Great Plains writer now that I've got two books out through this series. So there's no denying I'm a Great Plains writer. It's just I can't escape that, and I wouldn't want to. So I'm embracing it more, and my new fiction is all taking place here.
Stephen Wingate is the author of the new novel, The Leave Takers, out from the University of Nebraska Press. You can find out more on his website, stephenwingate.com. And again, the book is available online and in print. Stephen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Doug. This has been a wonderful pleasure. I appreciate it.
Coming up on Main Street, Charlie Johnson, the president of the Fargo-Moorhead Convention and Visitors Bureau, will join us to talk about a bill in the legislature that his organization opposes. That's coming up. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The manufacturing sector in North Dakota and the Mid-America region started 2021 on a strong note, and a new survey of manufacturing supply managers shows that enthusiasm is continuing. Dr. Ernie Goss is a professor of economics at Creighton University. He also conducts the 9-State Mid-American Business Conditions Index.
The overall index is, I would call it, soaring.
Goss says tempering the good news was the fact the rate the inflation rocketed to a record high. Goss says Federal Reserve Bank Chairman Jay Powell has indicated they are okay with the rate of inflation. Goss says that's something to keep track of over the next 3 to 6 months.
What we have to keep an eye on is how high does it go. And keep an eye on the 10-year Treasury. That yield, that's bounced about 0.6% higher over the last several months. So that's putting some pressure on interest rates. Interest rates are rising out there. Mortgage rates are rising. And that's going to put some pressure on the housing market.
For North Dakota, the February index marked another month of growth, gaining 0.4 of a point to check in at 76. Anything over 50 marks continued economic growth. Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner says to have a special session in November to deal with redrawing legislative district boundaries won't happen because the census numbers will not be ready until the end of September.
It moves the session down to December or maybe even into January of the next year.
Wardner says the legislature doesn't want to go too much further than that.
People need to run. And when you do redistricting and reapportionment, there are people that are going to have to run because their district has changed so much. Even if they ran 2 years ago, they're going to have to run, or this past year. So it is critical that we get it done before, I would say, the middle of January. That'd be the latest we could go, but we'd try to get it done in December if we could.
Wardner said the plan is to have a special redistricting committee who will hold a series of public hearings around the state and then will present the plan in a special session. And in the spending bill for the state's Office of Management and Budget, the House added a study of space needs in the state capitol. This comes in the wake of a pandemic when a number of state employees started working from home. Governor Burgum has said he thinks a number of them will continue to work from home, freeing up space in the state capitol. But Cooperstown Republican Representative Don Vigasaw told the House,
"Because I think over time, some that said initially they were going to work at home are going to find out that they miss the networking and the social aspect of being back at work. So I think it's appropriate that we study that over the next interim to decide what's going to be the best use of our space here at the Capitol."
Vigasaw said the Burgum administration had proposed levying rent for every general fund agency for the space they need in the Capitol. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Charlie Johnson. He's the president of the Fargo-Moorhead Convention and Visitors Bureau. We're going to talk about tourism and conventions and the lack of business due to the pandemic, and, of course, the legislature's in session. Charlie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Doug. There's a lot to talk about these days.
Let's start with, how bad was 2020 for the businesses you hoped to draw and the events you were promoting?
I think one word would sum it up. It was pretty much wretched for the entire hospitality sector. And I'm talking about hotels, travel, bars and restaurants, entertainment venues, attractions, especially our nonprofit attractions in the city, but all of them really. I'm pretty sure it wasn't that great for retail in any community as well. So it basically stunk, if I can use that word. Our revenue, we're funded by the 3% lodging tax in Fargo, Moorhead, and West Fargo. Our revenue for 2020, the calendar year, was off about 40%. That was after, you know, starting the year pretty well. So it was a bad year. Things have started to recover a little bit for us, kind of in fits and starts, you know, depending on how things went through last summer. Our low point for occupancy in Fargo, Moorhead, West Fargo came in April, when we were down to about 18% occupancy. And normally that time of year, it would have been in the, you know, upper 50s to 60, low 60%. And that lasted, you know, most of that month. And we slowly started to crawl out of that hole as some business travel came back. And then things picked up a little bit in the summer, quite a bit in the summer, actually, when we actually had some sporting events that came back. Because for a while there was an easing of restrictions when cases seemed to plateau and maybe even dropped off a little bit. So we had some summer sports activity that helped us. I think we got almost to 50% occupancy mid-summer, maybe in July and August. But then in the fall, when the cases jumped up again and the new restrictions went into place, we fell back into the low to mid 30% range. And that carried us pretty much through Christmas. But now things have started to come back a little bit again. Last week, we had, in this market, we had 55% occupancy, which that's got to be the highest we've had a year ago, at least. And that was largely due to the fact that we had one weekend where we had a squirt tournament, one of the three squirt tournaments. We also had a multi-team tournament on the Moorhead side in hockey. And then we also had North Dakota State Wrestling in town. So that really boosted things up a little bit. I'll get the one for last week. We should be, I bet we'll stay over 50 because we had two more tournaments last weekend, didn't have any state tournament action. But so sports has been carrying us, you know, but everyone has been suffering deeply. I mean, I could go into all sorts of tales of woe about the bars and restaurants and the hotels.
Yeah.
But it's been an awful year, awful full 12 months, basically almost now that we're in March.
How are you proceeding with convention and tourism planning in the vaccination transition we're in now?
A couple things. Sports will continue to build. We're pretty confident. We've always had a stronger sports market than meetings market here, largely because we have lots of great sports facilities, but not any true convention space. So we've always kind of leaned in that particular direction, and we made a conscious effort a few years ago to enlarge our sports department and go after more things, and we've had some success with that. The meetings industry is pretty much off the table, has been since a year ago almost. We're cautiously hoping for some comeback here maybe in the fall. We have our biggest conference that happens in Fargo in any given year is usually a district convention of the Jehovah's Witnesses. And this will be the second year in a row. They've already canceled it for July. Usually happens around the July 4th weekend. So we know that's out. That brings 4,000 people to town every year. So we've got 2 years of losing that. We assume they'll be back, hope they'll be back. We love having them here next year. But that's 2 years of a giant meeting we've totally lost. We've got lots of things starting to show interest and even some booking for fall of 2021, maybe late summer. And then I think things will finally start to get back to normal next spring. I think the economy for travel is going to open up quite a bit this summer. I know you follow this, Doug, with the increase in availability of the vaccine that seems to be starting now and will continue into early summer. I think once enough people get vaccinated, things will open up significantly. I think you'll see lots of economic activity just in the community in general as people satisfy their pent-up demand to get out of the house, you know, and that'll include some traveling too. And then I think just from a local standpoint, I believe the economy will come, the retail and including the hospitality economy will come kind of roaring back in the fall when the kids come back for college. So I think we're on the upward trend. But you can't forget that everything that's been lost is lost. You can't get it back. We have some conferences that were supposed to be here in 20 or 21 that have been pushed, and they'll come in 22. So we didn't lose them completely, but we really did because they will never, you know, they're just coming later, and we just missed that whole almost 2 years worth of business that you can never make up. So we'll just have to move forward from there.
You mentioned that there's this pent up demand, and I feel it myself. I'm ready to go somewhere, and I know lots of other people are too. So there's going to be, I think, predictably a bit of a spike when people feel more comfortable about going. But right. Have behaviors changed over the course of this time? I'm thinking about all those business meetings that are now done, you know, virtually.
That's a good question and one that gets asked a lot. I think ultimately there's going to be some desire for some people who said they could save a lot of money by doing a virtual meeting. But I also have my own personal feeling about it, and that is that most of the people who go to conferences and conventions, especially if they only go once or twice a year, to convene with their peers and get to see people they don't see very often, I think they're not going to be satisfied with that. I know I wouldn't be. There is no comparison, in my estimation, between a virtual conference and a live conference, where you travel to a place, stay in one place for 2-3 nights, and get to commune with your fellow WEGs and wizards from all over the region or country, you know. The content can be just as good. No question about that. Can be just as interesting. But it's hard to make it as interesting when it's on a screen and you're sitting in your office and you can so easily be distracted by things. And plus, from my standpoint, you lose the element of human interaction with your peers from whatever region you're convening with because you don't get to sit around a table while the person is presenting, you know, make comments to each other, snarky and otherwise, you know, but mostly you're interested. You're more interested and you're more engaged in listening to what's going on because you can share your thoughts about it with your friends at the table. And then, of course, that continues on later when you go to dinner or to have a reception, and you continue to talk about those things. So I think there's no substitute whatsoever for the live meeting. But yes, I think for a while we'll see some companies or some organizations, associations, whatever, that will try to do the virtual to at least save money in the short term.
Have the relief bills passed by Congress helped the Convention and Visitors Bureau?
Well, the first round didn't. There was virtually nothing of significance available to 501c6s, which most of the destination marketing organizations like us are. It was specifically excluded from the first CARES Act. They did change that in the second round. So now organizations like ours can apply for some assistance. There were a couple things in the first CARES Act, but mostly they were loans, you know, which made it a little less attractive to people.
And the $1.9 trillion proposal that's currently in play that's passed the House, that doesn't include
right.
any specific provisions that would benefit Convention and Visitors Bureaus?
I'd be lying if I said I'd studied it closely. I believe it includes some extension of PPP. And I'm hoping that for my colleagues around the country that they will include the 501c6s as they did the second time, not the first time. So hopefully that'll be the case for those of us who need it. That would be a good thing. Other than that, I haven't studied it from that specific standpoint.
The legislature is in session, so let's bring it to the state here. How is the Convention and Visitors Bureau poised in terms of its relation with the budgetary decisions that's going to have to be made?
Individual CVBs have their own budgets. We have our own
yes.
budget funded by the 3% lodging tax, Fargo-Moorhead and West Fargo, just like all the CVBs around the state. But we are closely intertwined with our state tourism groups. And in our case, we have a foot both in North Dakota and Minnesota. But obviously, more of our population is on the North Dakota side. More of our businesses are on the North Dakota side. So we watch that one particularly carefully. And frankly, Minnesota has always been pretty good about funding the promotion of travel and tourism in the state of Minnesota. North Dakota side has been a little different. I've been in this business now for 9 years. So the tourism budget has basically fluttered, you know, barely over $5 million over the last few years, with a couple of one-time infusions of maybe $500,000 to $750,000 for specific projects. So we've been debating this with the legislature for years. Everyone in the industry, even though it's not our money as individual CVBs, we recognize how symbiotically connected we are with North Dakota tourism and how much we do together, how much we depend on each other. So we have lobbied hard to try to get the legislature over the years to increase that spending, because it's woefully underfunded compared to any of the states around us. Minnesota has been spending at least three times North Dakota's budget for years. South Dakota, 2 to 2.5 times. Montana, 2 to 2.5 times, maybe 3 some years. Wyoming, same thing. Wisconsin, same thing. It's hard to compete, you know, with that kind of cash being laid out for these other places. Our tourism division has done a remarkable job of getting the word out on such a low budget. So this year, oddly enough, due to the pandemic, and I say this cautiously, I feel like there is a new awareness of the need to promote the state. And I say this because, as I've told you, we've been trying for years to convince lawmakers that travel and tourism really are the third largest industry in the state after oil and agriculture. And we're a vital component to the whole operation of the state. And also the last couple sessions, we've been really trying to get them to understand that all the promotion that you do to attract visitors, in other words, all of the tourism promotion you do to attract visitors, is basically, especially at the community level, but statewide as well, is exactly the same thing that economic development departments promote to get people to bring their businesses here or to move here to join our sometimes shallow workforce. Everyone's promoting the same thing, just for slightly different reasons. And by the way, very few people move to a community or a state without visiting first, right? So it all starts with a visit. So all the amenities that we promote in Fargo-Moorhead, West Fargo, to get visitors to come here and give them fun things to do while they're here, are the same things the Economic Development Corporation touts when they're selling the quality of life here. Same kind of thing. All the different attractions, all the wonderful bars and restaurants, the Fargo Dome, the Fargo Theater, all these great entertainment venues. It's all the same thing. We haven't made a lot of progress with that until now, but I think the fact that the pandemic showed everyone in the country, really, but especially here locally and in the state of North Dakota, how it hurt when the hospitality industry got shut down for such a long time and so dramatically compared to even many other businesses, they may have actually noticed that, whoa, that really maybe is the third largest industry in the state. We should probably pay some attention to that. So the Senate, we hit crossover last week, right? So this North Dakota Senate had the Commerce Bill First budget. They actually, voted to continue the budget the same as the last 2 years for tourism, but they added $7 million in one-time biennial spending. Again, that's that we do it one time just in case we don't want to do it next time. But $7 million increase for tourism marketing. Now that has to go to the House. That would be fabulous if we could get that. What a great boost that would be to promote the state of North Dakota and everything that it has to offer.
You know, when I was promoting this discussion before the news, I mentioned the transgender bill that has got through the North Dakota House. And that is something that people look at who are outside the state. And I understand that voting bills and transgender bills are sort of very popular with state legislatures now across the country. How do you think this particular bill might affect your business?
We're pretty sure that if it passes the Senate and is signed by the governor, it will have a severely negative impact on sports tourism, what we think of as sports tourism in our community for sure, and across the state for sure. Any city that hosts youth tournaments will see a negative impact from this. I wrote an email. I just found out about the revised version of this bill like the night before it was voted on in the House. So I dashed off an email to as many of them as I could think of, including the sponsors of the bill, and said, I think this is a really bad bill for a number of reasons. But I always couch this in terms of this. We're a public entity. I'm not trying to get into any emotional arguments. And there are lots of people who will make those arguments about this bill, the mental health arguments, whatever. I'm approaching this strictly from two standpoints. First of all, we believe the way this bill is written, and I don't know how it could be written any differently, it will make the state to be in conflict with all of the governing bodies and sanctioning bodies of youth sports around the country. And therefore, it will disqualify virtually all of our local facilities, which are almost all state-owned, state-run, state-funded, and which is part of the bill. We're talking about House Bill 1298, in case anybody wants to look it up. So it would disqualify all those facilities from hosting any tournament with a governing body's edicts that allowed for some transgender participation, depending on what their policies were. So we think that would have a hugely negative impact potentially on USA Wrestling in this community. And I know the lawmakers who pushed this forward were really thinking only about North Dakota high school activities, right? But it doesn't really say that. It says anyone under the age of 18. And that covers a whole huge gamut of sporting events that come through our community and across the state, including USA Wrestling. Every summer, hundreds of wrestlers come here for like 10 days, two weekends, and they produce about 8,000 room nights in our community every summer, half of them on the dorms, but half of them in our hotels. They spend their money in restaurants. They leave a lot of money here behind. And we support that event with cash assistance, both to NDSU and to USA Wrestling. According to this bill, if USA Wrestling allows a transgender athlete to wrestle in the division, men's or women's, that is different from their birth gender, then that couldn't be hosted at the Fargo Dome. Nor could we supply any money for it because we're tax supported. So basically that would be like a big thumb in the eye of U.S. wrestling. And basically they would pack up and leave. They don't need to mess with that. They don't need to worry about that. There have been people trying to lure USA Wrestling away from Fargo and the state for all of the 26 or 27 years it's been here. So that would probably be gone in a heartbeat.
Okay.
It would also potentially have a negative impact on Fargo youth hockey. Fargo youth hockey produces 12,000 room nights approximately every year in this community. That is nothing to sneeze at. People should really like hockey. Hockey's a great sport. They produce all of those room nights. And again, a lot of the teams come from out of state. And if there's a sanctioning body that doesn't agree with the new state law, then they're going to lose a lot of those teams. And I could just go on and on. There are all sorts of sports. Swimming is another big one. USA Swimming would not participate. They would not come to the Hallbert Aquatic Center. And according to the people who run the local swimming groups, it's very likely that they would not even be able to send their own swimmers to events out of the state because they'd be in such a direct conflict with the inclusion policies of those sports. So the Hallbert Aquatic Center, a world-class facility that just opened a few years ago and is just starting to come into its own, would cease to be able to host most of the events that we try to put in there.
Charlie Johnson is the president of the Fargo-Moorhead Convention and Visitors Bureau. We just heard a bottom-line argument.
I have one other argument against that, too, and that is, again, not emotional. This bill and the ones like it in other states all over the country are totally unnecessary in my estimation. I don't pretend to have any concept. I don't have any expertise, knowledge, or dare to have an opinion about when, where, how, or who against a transgender athlete should compete. That's not my expertise. And I would humbly submit that it's pretty much not the expertise of anyone in Bismarck, right? But on the other hand, all of the governing and sanctioning bodies of all of these sports all around the country, all around the world, and even in the state, including the North Dakota High School Activities Association, have been dealing with this issue for 50 years, probably, at some point, some of them later than others. But I remember hearing about this with regard to the Olympics back in 1960. You know, you and I are old enough to remember that. This is not a new issue that just popped up on a Hallmark movie at Thanksgiving. This is something that people have been dealing with forever. And every one of those governing bodies has what they believe is a nuanced, sophisticated, science-based, in most cases, policy for dealing with these issues, including the North Dakota High School Activities Association, which I think, you know, has its policy pretty well mirrored against the NCAA. They are already dealing with it. They have the expertise, or they've hired people who have the expertise. This is a totally unnecessary bill. It doesn't accomplish anything, in my view, except build an economic wall around the state so that the only kids that the North Dakota youth would be able to compete against anymore would be within the state, or maybe South Dakota if they pass the similar bill that's going on now. And there are a lot of states that wouldn't send their athletes here and probably wouldn't allow our athletes to go there.
Charlie Johnson is the president of the Fargo-Moorhead Convention and Visitors Bureau. Charlie, thanks for talking with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Dakota Datebook is next.
The Minot Symphony Orchestra will present A Little Night Music on Saturday, March 6th at 7:30 p.m. at MSU's Ann Nicole Nelson Hall. The concert features music by Mozart, Tchaikovsky, and a world premiere by Minot Symphony's own Matthew Benbenek. Limited seating is available in order to observe social distancing protocols. The performance will also be available online via live stream. Tickets for the performance must be purchased in advance and are available at MinotSymphony.com.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 1st. Statewide mandates to curb disease outbreaks are not new in North Dakota. In the summer of 1892, Governor Andrew Burke declared a quarantine against neighboring Manitoba due to a smallpox outbreak in a Canadian border town just north of Neche, North Dakota. The outbreak began in late July when a girl in Gretna, Manitoba, fell ill from smallpox, which was supposedly traced to men who worked at a town laundry. When several people fell ill, carpenters built six shanties on the prairie outside of Gretna to quarantine the sick patients. But the pox spread to two neighboring villages, and 3 days into the epidemic, all of Gretna was put under quarantine, with guards camped on the outskirts of town. With little help for nursing the growing number of sick people, the situation became desperate. A doctor from Nechi, who had taken charge, said some smallpox patients were wandering around in delirium unrestrained. Two nuns from Winnipeg came to help. The home of the men who had allegedly carried the pox to Gretna was fumigated with sulfur and recommended to be burned, along with its contents. Health authorities advised that Gretna residents be vaccinated, but many people were apathetic about vaccination. The week after the first case of smallpox, North Dakota's governor announced the quarantine. Trains were barred from crossing the border. Postal carriers were protected by armed guards to exchange mail at the boundary. Guards were also stationed along the border. Some newspapers reported that the quarantine wasn't rigorously enforced and that some trains still ran. In response, the authorities in North Dakota tore up a stretch of railroad tracks. The governor was criticized at home and abroad. Manitoba's premier thought the quarantine was too severe. Winnipeg residents were indignant. Some travelers were stranded. An opinion in a Jamestown newspaper called the quarantine unnecessary and premature and said the governor is always looking for a chance to affix his official signature to any kind of high-sounding document. Governor Burke lifted the quarantine after 10 days as the outbreak waned. 10 people were known to have fallen ill in Manitoba, and at least 4 died. The 1893 legislature passed a bill to reimburse Pembina County more than $1,100 for costs incurred due to the quarantine. Around this time that year, new governor, Eli Shortridge, signed the bill. Governor Burke had lost re-election in 1892. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
In Montana, a college student gathers up his belongings. Keys, wallet, phone, and his gun.
You're not looking for a fight, but you're willing to finish it.
A new law will allow him to carry that firearm on campus, and that concerns some other students.
Just the thought of someone having a gun in the dining hall when I'm just trying to eat a sandwich in the morning. That's scary.
Will schools push back? On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream online at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast or stream, you can find any Main Street show right there, archived as a podcast at prairiepublic.org. On our show Tuesday, a book and upcoming PBS special dives into the Right to Die movement. Ashley Thornburg will visit with Diane Rehm. She's the author and host of When My Time Comes, conversations about whether those who are dying should have the right to determine when life should end. Rehm's book looks at the issues around dying in 21st century America. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.